Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to The Mentor. I'm Mark Boris. Kim O'Leary, welcome to The Mentor. Thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Where'd you come down from?
Toowoomba.
Oh, wow. Toowoomba,
which is a bit west of Brisbane.
Yeah, the Darling Downs, up high up there, God's country, beautiful soil, very good for farming. Also, pretty big growth territory these days, going quite well.
It is definitely high growth. There's a lot of the gas industry, farming's thriving, and now we've got a workwear business there.
Well, most people don't realise that Queensland is one of the biggest gas producers in the world and has some of the biggest natural gas reserves in the world too. New South Wales, we don't have too much down here. Victoria doesn't have much either. But Queensland has enough to supply the whole of the country. Unfortunately, most of it gets exported. But nonetheless, it's a big industry, employs a lot of people. And, of course, we're going to talk about how your business sort of dovetails into that environment. So you're the founder and inventor of CoGear, C-O, as in, I don't know what it says, carbon and oxygen. What are we talking about here?
CoGear comes from my name. So Clark is my maiden name and O'Leary is my married name. So that's where the name comes from.
Okay, because as soon as I see CO, I mean, I immediately think of I've been reading a lot lately about chemistry of amino acids, and I've been doing a bit of work on it, and long chain amino acids, and et cetera. And when I see the letters CO, I immediately think of COOH, and then I start to drop in a nitrogen atom, et cetera, and I start to think about proteins. But I'm talking about in the body as opposed to what we drink. But so anyway, that's a slightly different tangent. But you grew up in a small place in it's actually quite famous for that. And I don't know why. I was only thinking about this the other day. How come we don't see bowl mangoes anymore? Everywhere I went, I used to see bowl mangoes. Now I see Kensington Pride. Maybe the Kensington Pride comes from Bowen. Can you just tell me just a little bit, because you obviously come from that town, Bowen, right?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't we see them anymore?
Yeah, I don't know, because they're very tasty. A lot of Bowen has grafted their mango trees to now do R2E2s. They look better in the shopping centres, like they're bigger and have more flesh, and I think people assume they're better value. But I'm with you, Mark. The special Bowen specials are delicious.
But still a mango, very much of a mango town, so to speak.
Definitely. I grew up on a mango farm.
Yeah. Well, I've got mango trees in my place, and I just want to ask you a question because I know it sounds a bit off track. We're going to talk about your stuff in a second. But it's actually hard to produce a mango. If you get too much rain, I notice that all the mango flowers fall off. If it gets too much water, if it doesn't get enough water, it's equally not as good, no good. And then, of course, you've got to make sure you stop the possums and the birds and every other bloody thing, rats, et cetera, climbing up the trees and eating them. And they absolutely know exactly when it is nearly going to be ripe. In other words, before you pick it, they know when to get there, and they just eat that little bit of the mango that's ripe and leave the rest of the bloody thing. But you can't harvest it yourself. You've got to throw it away. I'm always intrigued. You grew up on a mango farm. Did you guys learn tricks about how you grow mangoes? Did you learn all these little tricks?
Look, Mark, I think you've just described farming, right? We also have a tomato farm out the front, and it's a supply and demand thing. When it rains, prices increase. So if you have a bit of a crop, you'll get the revenue for it. And I think then you water at certain times. So it means the flowers come at the certain times, and then they're ready to pick for when your area is good to go, sort of thing. But yeah, I think you've just described the challenges of farming pretty well.
How do you think growing up on a farm, tomato and mangoes, in a farming town, how do you find that has helped you, for example, in relation to the way you approach your workwear, women's workwear business?
That's a good question. I think, well, initially, it's work ethic, right? So ever since I was little, we had mango trees down the back, but then there was also one in the garden and you had to pick up the mangoes and chuck them to the cows, sort of thing. Or if the tomatoes, or we had sorghum growing, you'd have to move pipes. So I think that the work ethic is really built into you from quite a young age.
So what does work ethic mean though? Does that mean get up routine, get up a certain time, irrespective of how you feel, summer, yeah, winter, it doesn't matter whether it's, well, you don't have daylight saving over there, but like, you know, long days, short days. Well, what does work ethic mean to you?
Yeah, it means to me that's it is continuous work no matter how you feel. If it is a bad season in relation to farming, you've just got to dust yourself up and try again next season. So I think to me, work ethic is building in a resilience as well. That means you can just keep going. Like if it's time to, you know, it's even like mowing the lawn, right? After rain, you might have a flu, but you still need to go and mow the lawn, because otherwise if you leave it for a week, it'll get it out of hand and it'll double the work that you've got to put in. So it's building in the consistency, maybe the routine, the resilience, to just keep moving forward.
And because I often wonder about farmers, I mean, I've only got a couple hundred acres, but it's bad enough. I've got a cattle stud, but, and you're right, I got a bush mango tree there, like it yields so many bush mangoes, which are crappy. You can eat it, they're edible, but they're sort of stringy and all that sort of shit, so you just feed them with the animals.
They could be commons.
Yeah.
That's a breed of them as well,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yes, and like, I didn't plant it. Some previous farmer planted it, and it's right in front of my house. And if you don't pick up the mangoes, the rats get them. If the rats come in, you know what happens after the rats. So, you know, we have to go and pick all these things up no matter how you feel. And it's always on the shittiest day, not me, I got people live up there, staff. But on the shittiest day, of course, you know, that's going to be the day that most of them land all over the joint. And it looks pretty untidy as well. Mm. I look at these guys and they just manage to continually – I don't know how they do it. They just get going, keep going, keep going, keep going, year after year. And they've been there for 20 odd years, 23 years with me, same guys. And they never give up.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think what you're saying to me is that Kim, the kid brought up on the farm, you know, who lived this sort of lifestyle, actually has an advantage in terms of running a business like you're running, because irrespective of whether you come up with a brilliant invention, which you have, and irrespective of whether you really were able to had a sufficient awareness to meet a demand that you recognised, they're sort of creative traits, but at the end of the day, it's got to be executed on. And there's a lot of errors, a lot of failures, a lot of disappointments, a lot of letdowns. That's the farmer's life. And yeah, you got to keep smiling like you're doing right now. And it just, you're nodding towards me, but people in the city, I don't have a crack at the people in the city, but the people in the city don't necessarily get it. And I'm not saying one's better than the other, don't get me wrong. But there's something about the resilience. I don't know whether it's Australian farmers or global farmers globally, but there's something about them that actually really builds people's resilience in any endeavor they take. Have you ever really thought and blessed yourself as to that exposure you got?
I've never given it that much thought, Mark, I'll be honest, but I grew up, mum had her own business, dad had his own business, then they did things together, and then we looked after the farm in the spare time. So I've grown up with people having a lot on their plate, and I think as the age-old saying goes, busy people get more done. I've really lent in to that, and it's you've probably got experience with this, but the 80-20 rule, you'll find, you know, 80% of the work or generates 20% of the income. So vice versa is 20% of your work generates 80% of your income. So it's really leaning into the tasks that will bring the money and kind of letting go of the bits and pieces that maybe the fun work, but they don't actually generate the income.
Do you think too many people are looking for the there's no fun in this job? Like, I mean, because for me, people might be looking at you now going, oh, yeah, but, you know, what a cool business and look at this and success. But most of it's not fun. I mean, most of it's pretty tough.
Yeah, but
where do you find the fun?
Fun, look, if tough can be fun. Like, I know if you go to the gym, it's a hard workout, but you feel good and it's kind of fun, like, after it. So I honestly think work can be fun, and it's the struggle that you go through gives you the opportunity to value the fun a little bit more. And, like, I think of workwear and where it started to where it is now, like, the first designs we brought out, they were rubbish. Like, I knew there was a market there for it, but it was pretty ordinary because I didn't lean into listening to my customer that well. I refinanced my investment property to buy this stock that's still sitting in our warehouse that I need to get rid of. So going through that struggle or heartache at the beginning, you've gone too far and I've wasted too much money on here just to pull out. And I think bringing that back to farming and how I grew up, like, there might be a bad season or, you know, some job didn't go to plan, but if you push through that, you can see that that brings innovation and that brings other opportunities that you may have missed if things went well initially.
Yeah, that's interesting. So did you actually articulate that in your mind, or these are looking back? These are things you just did instinctively as a result of probably your background? Or is that something you said, hang on, I know what happened in the farming environment and I know you're going to get knockbacks, but eventually I'm going to find out what works?
Like, I have reflected on this, but if I even look back into school, like, I was never a smart kid, right? I was the kid that got the report cards that said, Kim tries really, really hard and she's a really great listener. I was like, another one. Like, all I want them to say is she's got great potential and she's going to be smart, or she is smart. I never got that feedback. I grew up with two sisters and a brother. Both my sisters were really great at sport. I never was. I went to training and I tried, but I was never that good. But I think it was that knockbacks in the early years and the, okay, just keep going and you'll get there. It's that never giving up mindset. So I think a lot of my childhood and school, it didn't go the way I wanted to, but on reflection, that's taught me some really great lessons.
Can you take me back to when, because, I mean, I find it fascinating, you still got the original stock that you mortgaged your property.
Oh, it's in a little shed out the back.
Can you take me back to that point? So how long ago are we talking about? And what was the inspiration to kick off a woman's workwear? Like, you know, were you at that stage, were you in Bowen? Were you out of Bowen? Tell me to the whole scenario.
So just to give you a bit more background at me, I left school when I was 15. I was working in a law firm for a couple of years. I was getting a lift to work that day and I thought, is this going to be my life for the rest of my life?
Whereabouts is this?
That was in Bowen. And I said to myself, no, time to make a change. There was a TAFE course you could do at uni that did grade 11 and TAFE course at TAFE, you'll do grade 11 and 12 in 1 year and then get into uni. But you had to be 18 to start that course, and I was only 17. But mum's like, ignore that, I'll help you get in. And she did when I was 17. And I think that lesson there, where mum showed me that sometimes rules are more guidelines than rules, and you've got to ask for what you want to get to where you think you want to go as well. So anyway, got into uni, studied commerce, and then applied for a mining commercial graduate job and was successful, and I ended up in Central Queensland in Middlemount. And so I'd done my grad program with them. They actually gave me 12 months off to go travel and grow and learn and explore and come back, and you can have your job back. So I grabbed that opportunity. And when it was, I'd come back, I was working at Foxley, which is a small mine in Central Queensland, still near Middlemount. And my manager was pregnant at the time. I loved, and I still really admire, the mining industry. I think it brings the world forward, but I really enjoyed working in it. But deep down, seeing my parents have their own businesses when I was young, that's what I really wanted to do. And I had this realization when I was at work, I always wanted to have a business, and I realized I wouldn't just wake up one morning and have it. I've actually got to create it. So that was in the back of my mind. And when I was working, I was a management accountant there. Steph, my manager, was pregnant. Steph, because it was quite a small mine, they didn't have a replacement to Steph, and they invited me along to a leadership meeting. Just sit in the back corner, Kim, take some notes, try and answer the questions that are being directed to Steph, and answer them. So, you know, professional development sort of stuff.
Well, what are you wearing?
I mean, high vis.
Wear high vis. Yep. Everybody does.
So we're on site. As soon as you entered into the mining lease, everyone has to be in high vis workwear.
So the moment you get through the gates and you're on the site, you have to wear site gear.
You do.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
That's company issued. Everyone. Okay. Yep. Even contractors that come in, they have to have high vis.
And high vis being, like bright colored type stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Something that complies with standards. Yep. So typically that's just orange or yellow with tape or no tape. So Steph was pregnant. We were in this meeting. It was
How
a leadership meeting.
About?
7 months.
So well, that's pregnant.
Quite pregnant. So you could see it. And in this meeting there was about six men in the leadership team, and then there was Steph. And they were all sitting around this boardroom type table, and all the men were sitting there super comfy, not a care in the world in relation to their clothing. And there was Steph, 7.5 months pregnant, sitting there in an open high-vis shirt on with the singlet on underneath. And, you know, it's summer, Central Queensland, hot. Not exactly comfortable.
Trousers? Would you have trousers?
Yeah, long pants as well.
So Where was the stomach? I mean, how do you pull the trousers down or something? I mean, below the stomach sort of thing.
Yeah, you can get things like bands and different things to put on, but like you described, not comfortable, not ideal.
Probably shitty looking too.
Sorry?
Probably pretty shitty looking.
Yeah, and I think that all plays a part. You know, when you feel comfortable and confident, you project better. So there I was sitting in the back corner, and I was like, we as the mining industry are trying to get more women into the industry, yet we're not providing clothing that's suitable for all stages of a woman's life. And I just parked that in the back of my head, and then we did the meeting and moved on. And then that night I went home and started to think, I need to get Steph some clothes. So I just Googled, and there was nothing. Worldwide, no maternity, high vis. And then the penny dropped. I was like, this is my chance to do something that can make a change for women. So I started just Googling how to make clothes. You know, Mark, this is my naivety, but I didn't even know that I could contact someone in Australia. I found someone in the US and she kind of mentored me. So I was getting up at all hours of the night, doing that at nighttime, and then would wake up and go to site and be at my desk by 6:30. So it was all over the shop, but yeah, I wanted to have something that was mine.
So would you say that the very first step, I mean, apart from the luck of being invited into the meeting to take notes, that's luck. But at the very first, well, then again, you put yourself in the right position, I guess. But the very first step in the recognition of the demand was more an empathetic move. So you felt empathy towards your line manager, to your pregnant line manager. So, was that a, I guess I want to ask you, like sitting there in the, wherever you were in the room, were you feeling not sorry for her, but you sort of saying, wow, that does look very comfortable? What was that going through your head? Was that an empathetic moment?
Yeah, and it was the heat, right? You've probably been to central Queensland or Queensland in
been to Mount Isa mid-summer. A few times.
Exactly. Like, you don't want to be wearing extra layers. Just the fact you're wearing a long sleeve shirt is bad enough, let alone being pregnant on site. And that point in my life, I hadn't been pregnant, but I'd heard people say, like, hormones and you just get hot. Like, I think, yeah, there was part of me that I just wanted to help Steph.
Yeah, empathy. It's another word.
She was
a
friend. Yeah, she was my manager, but she was my friend.
And then, so you went and you talked to this person in America, but when did you sit down with a pen and paper and start drawing up what more comfortable women's workwear would maybe look like? Did you sort of, because I don't know, did you draw it or what was the process?
Not very artistic. I think I'm more of a, you know, I like going and have a looking at shops, and you could see sort of elements if you pulled it from here or there or do the stomach like this. And then I went and got a sample made. Well, I jumped a few steps there. I asked Mum if she wanted to come to China with me and, yeah, have a look at a few of these factories. Like, looking back, not ideal factories, but I came back to Australia and I thought we were almost there. Like, I just had to make a few more decisions and then we'd get our sample. I sent those emails off. I've never heard back to this day from the bloke that we met in China. So I've since learnt a bit about the culture and how it works, and if it's a yes, it's a maybe, and if it's a no, it's a definite no, like all of those sort of things. And at that point in time, I thought I'd gone too far to turn around. In hindsight, I should have ran. Like, it was the moment that I could have just quit and went back to my, you know, great job in mining. But instead, I found a company in Brisbane that was called China Direct Sourcing at the time, and you could go to them. You paid for it. You paid a lot more, but at least you were guaranteed a product. So I did that and then got samples and then sold it back into Anglo-American at the time.
You actually got the samples and you went to Anglo-American, who was the owner of the mine, I guess,
yeah,
and just said, why don't we get this? What was your approach?
Well, it was pretty basic. Like, Steph was on site. She needed high vis. Here's a solution. There's no other option in the world at that point. So it was sort of a no-brainer for them. Like, they could see that they wanted to attract more women. Not having uniforms that fit them was definitely a roadblock.
So did you send to the CEO or did you know the individual you sent it to?
Yeah, I guess being inside that company, you knew that there was a diversity and inclusion space. The lady that was in that role at the time previously, she'd worked on site in HR, so you did have connections. But in saying that, everything was arm's length transactions. I ended up having to resign from that job to continue the deal. So there was risks along the way for me as well. Like, and at this point in time, I had stock, but little did I know it was never going to really sell.
How much stock did you buy?
At the time, it was only an MOQ of 300. Right. So it wasn't big. And I could afford the orange navy at the time. I couldn't afford the yellow navy. And that's what I refinanced my investment property for. And then we brought out two women's style shirts as well, like non-pregnant. And they didn't sell either.
So when you say they didn't sell, Anglo-American didn't buy from you? Or the
quantities just weren't there. Right.
How do you mean?
Well, there weren't many women on site to start with. And then I was targeting pregnant women. Yeah, exactly. So you just didn't have the volume. And this was at the start of you know, them really seeing the benefits in having more women on site. So they were really just starting to change. Like, this was at the point in the industry on the mine site, you have what's called a mining circuit, and that would be, you know, you go and pick the dirt up from there and dump it over here. And on those circuits, men could easily go to the toilet. They just stop their truck and go to the bathroom, like not a physical bathroom.
Yeah, behind the
yeah,
truck.
Exactly. Women, they'd worked out, weren't drinking water because there were no bathroom toilet facilities. So this is where we were, right? We weren't at a developed stage or journey.
It's interesting.
Getting women.
It's interesting. Women wouldn't drink water just so they didn't have to go to the toilet.
Yeah, but you can't. So every time the circuit stops for a certain time, like, it's all scheduled. So you have how many trucks are on the circuit to make sure the digger's running efficiently. So, and if you stop and then have to get in a light vehicle, drive to the crib room, go to the bathroom, like, that's a significant delay that can have an impact on production that affects the company's bottom line in revenue. So what was your choice?
Yeah, you don't want to upset the efficiency of the whole business just because you need to take a pee. Yeah. So can you just, before I go to the break though, I just want to ask you, ultimately it was successful in terms of what you ultimately designed, because you're obviously selling it, but you actually, it sounds like you're riding a wave of women coming into, or riding the diversity wave, particularly in relation to women coming into the mining industry. Which one of these in front of me here is the, you know, the first initial successful design?
The jacket, which we just evolved.
This one?
Yeah.
So Co-Gear, women's workwear, always comfortable, cogear.com.au. Take that off. So this is like a, wow, it's a pretty cool jacket actually.
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people design stuff today. They pinch some. You just got to look at something. There's no point trying to redesign it. I mean, did you get inspired by any jackets or hoodies or something that you'd seen?
Yeah, definitely. Pre-babies, I spent a lot of time at the gym exercising. So exercise clothes were a lot of the inspiration. You need to move. You need to move, and that's what working was. So there was definitely inspiration linked there.
Tell me about this design. Like, yeah, what was specific about this relative to, say, women? Like, what?
So this jacket, just a bit of a backstory there. You know, the sales in the original shirts never went particularly well, so I'd pretty much given up. I'd moved, driven across Australia, landed in Perth, knocked on a lot of mining companies' doors, called BHP, and just cold called, and eventually got through to a guy that agreed to have coffee with me. Turns out didn't really go anywhere. That was 18 months of not really selling anything. And I'm like, I've still got investment property to pay off. So I need to go and get a job. I applied for a job at Curra and ended up back there. And so that's in Blackwater. I was about a year into that, and I got a call from this bloke at BHP in Perth. And he's like, Kim, are you still in the workwear game? No, I've stopped. Like, my gear just wasn't selling. I need to earn some money. And he's like, oh, right. I was like, oh, what are you chasing? He's like, oh, we want you to design a ladies' jacket for us. And I was like, oh, look, just call the big guys. They'll be happy to help you. He's like, look, I've called and they're not interested in changing any of their designs. They think what's there is adequate. And he's like, will you please have a go?
What was driving him though?
Well, he was a contracts specialist, and BHP a few years ago, Andrew McKenzie, the CEO at the time, said we want 50-50 gender split by 2025. And what that did was cause like a ripple effect down the business. Well, what's stopping people from coming to work with us? That's when things like truck circuits and the water and, you know, we put portaloos out there. So we solved that. And then the next one was workwear. Women are constantly complaining. They're not buying the uniform, like they're not wearing the uniform. They're going off site, making modifications to jeans so they can wear them on site, like by sewing tape and stuff on them. And it's that that wasn't safe. So he wanted to create a uniform that the women wanted to wear. And he first approached the people that were currently supplying, and they were like, look, our gear's moving, we're not changing it. And that's because it had to be issued, but that didn't mean the end users were wearing it. So yeah, I agreed to make up a sample reluctantly, got one made, and he was like, and then fly over to Perth. We'll get in 20 women from the Pilbara. We'll set you up in a little meeting room. They can just try on the jacket after another. So sure enough, jumped on a plane, went to Perth, met with them. We were sitting in the room together, and each woman come in individually, so they weren't influenced on the previous person, tried it on, moved on. Everyone loved it. So the meeting went afterwards, well, that's a no-brainer. We'll buy this jacket off you. I was like, no, you can't. I can't afford the minimum order quantity. And he was like, oh, right. And I said, because it's quite an involved jacket, it's not cheap.
It looks
cheap.
Complicated.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, that's fine. What's the MOQ? And I was like, 500. He's like, no sweat, we'll buy it. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, we're a big company, we can do that. And I was like,
they're a very big company.
Yeah, exactly. And with the support of their supply partner, who was Blackwoods at the time, or still is, we work very closely with them, we were added to the uniform list and the women could get the jacket. So even though the inspiration for the whole workwear line came from a maternity shirt, if it wasn't for this jacket, we wouldn't be here.
Okay, I'm going to go to the break, because when I come back from the break, I want to talk about your other trademarked and patented process called HMZ Hems, and the uniqueness of that in relation to the dacks or the pants. And I want to look at this shirt as well. I think this is them in front of me. Yeah, it is. And I would like to also talk to you about the business model that you have. I mean, how does the business model work? And particularly, is there global appetite for this? So we go to the break and we come straight back.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm here with Kim O'Leary. We've been talking about the sort of the inspiration to originally design, not so much the jacket, but, you know, what ended up being a jacket for BHP in West Australia. Of course, you know, lots of failures and lots of, moments where you probably thought this is never going to actually happen. And you got this great looking jacket out and you got your first order. And did you say $500?
No, 500. MOQ was 500.
Okay, yeah. 500. So where does the first, before I talk about hems, where does the shirt fit in? Or was the shirt just like a natural consequence of the jacket? Because this is a big, heavy jacket. This would be pretty hot to wear. Yeah. What about the rest of the stuff like this, for example?
Yeah, sure. So after the jacket was a success, they knew that we had maternity wear, but they also knew it wasn't the greatest design.
Right.
So they said, Kim, you've solved this jacket problem for us. Can you redesign the women's maternity range? And they said, the brief is, when we're looking at a pregnant person and a non-pregnant person, straight, we don't want to tell the difference. So what we mean by that is the shirt has to be tucked in. We have to comply with all the standards.
Why is that? Is that some sort of rule? Shirts can't be loose?
It's a risk assessment. So if you're working in a zone on the mine that there could be a catch hazard, you need to reduce that.
So you don't want something flying around the joint because it could get caught on the machine.
Exactly. Right. Yep. So we had a pretty big challenge in front of us because in accordance with the standards, you can only use certain fabrics, which a lot of them are non-stretch, right? So having a tight fitting option was just never going to work. So we had a few workshops in Moranbah, and they sort of told us what they liked and what they didn't like. Everything was just what they didn't like. There was no, you could do this and that. Looking back, that was also powerful because I really heard why they didn't like the first design, which was great. But it took about 18 months to redesign it. And what we ended up doing was we looked at a women's shirt. You typically have a bust art. And what a bust art does is offers room across the bust for women. So we took that thought.
Women.
Yeah. So we took that thought and said, what about if we apply that thinking to the pregnant person? And we added this belly dart to the maternity shirt. So it meant you could wear it when you were early in the pregnancy and just tuck it in, or as you grow, it expands.
So the belly dart, this is this thing here, which you probably can't see on camera, but that's that line there.
Yeah.
How does it expand? Oh, I understand.
No, it doesn't expand. What it does, Mark, think of it like a fold under the garment.
Yeah.
So that gives then more space where you need it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a really flattering way to create volume without it looking really bad.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay.
So then we did the shirt, we trialed it on site, and everyone was over the moon. But where it got a bit tricky was the maternity pants. From a stock management perspective and cash flow, we only wanted to bring in one design of maternity pants.
So they couldn't have a size, 32, 34, 36, 38, whatever.
No, we could for one style though. So where we landed was one over tummy design and one under tummy design. So over tummy was if you were working in an office or you'd done a risk assessment and means you don't have to tuck your shirt in. Or the under tummy allowed you to tuck it in, and that hit our brief, right? Because at the beginning it was the brief is looking at a non-pregnant and a pregnant person, you must look the same. So the under tummy hit the brief, they were happy, but being pregnant, everyone likes something different. So women get support from wearing clothing over their tummy because it offers a bit more support. But then so we went out basically and we had these two pants. We thought we'd survey the women and whichever style won, that's what we'd bring into stock. You wouldn't believe it, but it came back 50-50. Huh. So then we were faced with, well, what do we do? And we made a decision with our customers that we'd offer both. So both styles are on the uniform list. So we ended up with two pants and one shirt, which isn't a bad outcome because now after experiencing pregnant, I get why you want an option. So I think, it was just come down to asking the customer and we'd done that and we'd engaged, so I knew this stock was going to move. So we successfully ticked off the maternity redesign project. So now we'd sort of got a name in the industry for being the problem solvers, and that's then when I was asked about, well, Kim, now we're looking at the uniform list. We're trying to create a uniform list where if a men's product has an option, we need to offer the same for women. And what that meant in men's pants, they can come in the S regular or tall. Yeah. And so they wanted our pants to come out having different length options because, as we know, we're not all the same height. And when they told me this, I was just like, you're dreaming. Like, I don't have the cash flow. We're a small business. We just can't do it. But I didn't say anything. I just shut my mouth and thought, let's have a think about it. And then that night I went home and I was talking to Stu, my husband, and I was like, this is the challenge we've now been given. And he's like, oh, let's just chuck some steaks on the barbecue and we'll crack a bottle of wine and see where the night goes, sort of thing. And then we started talking about it, and because he'd grown up on a farm as well, so sheep and cattle and, you know, grain was around, bags of grain, and Stu was like, have you ever opened a bag of grain? And I'm like, yeah, chook feed. We had chooks. And he's like, yeah, remember how you open it? If you pull it one way, it comes undone really easily. If you pull it the other, it sort of gets jammed up. And he's like, can't you just put that on a pair of work pants and then offer the different lengths? I'm like, Stu, I'm sure it's not that easy, but I'll look into it tomorrow. So, yeah, woke up the next day and then I got it working. I thought, look, I'm just going to call a patent lawyer and see if this has legs. And I called the bloke and he's like, yeah, I'm just in Brisbane. I'll come and see you in Toowoomba. So I showed him what I was thinking and he's like, yeah, I think this is unique enough to get it covered by
a patent.
How did
you find a patent lawyer?
Google.
Oh, really? Serious?
Yeah. You can find anything on Google.
But some dude in Brisbane?
Yeah, it turns out to be really good. And I'd then asked around the industry and they're like, yeah, you're in safe hands with him. So he used to work for a big firm, like a big Gaydon's or something like that, and he'd gone off on his own. So he wasn't charging like ridiculous prices like a big law firm with the overheads or something like a small business could afford. And so he got us a provisional patent. What is it? I think it's a provisional patent. Anyway, it was the first stage. And what that meant was you were granted this and then you had 12 months to get it working in a factory space, but it was protected. So I could go to our factories and say, this is what we're doing and can you help? And yeah, they agreed. So I put in an order for, you know, that met the minimum order quantity and was just like, well, when we get this function working, you can manufacture this. And they were like, yeah, we'll give it a shot. So, you know, it was just hurdle after hurdle. They were like, oh, it can't be done. How are you going to secure the threads? We thought like, oh, is there an iron down thing? Can we use clips? Is there Velcro? And then it was, I was back at F45 at the time, bought some new workout stuff. I think it was Stu again, actually, who was doing the folding up and he ripped off the tag. So, you know, on Under Armour and stuff, yeah, you can tear away the tag. And so Stu ripped those off and was like, came out to see me and he said, could we secure that with a tearaway tag? I'm like, what's a tearaway tag? And he showed me because I'd never actually looked closely. I don't have a great attention to detail. And so then I bought some of those and we sent them to the factory and I said, can you apply this? And they're like, yeah, we can do that. And came over a few more hurdles then. They were like, I think we need something to secure it. So we made it sticky and if we give it a go, you can
show me
you
how
can
it works.
See.
So
the pants come in different leg length options. And then all you have to do, so the thread colors correspond with this tag. So if you want the shortest option, which is a 71 centimeter inseam, you find the orange thread, which is that one,
yep,
and then you tear away the tag.
You tear away the tag, yep.
Yep. You thread it back in the right way and then that's
all
released.
Off.
Yeah, and then you just have to use a bit of muscle and tear away the hem.
So I know, because I thought you were going to turn it back inside or something and just sticky there. But
super simple. And then these two bottom threads, they just pull off and then you've got
a shorter
hem. So it's really great when you're working in like central Queensland or the Pilbara or somewhere. You don't have like machinists or alterations people and you've got to drive a few hours to get them. So that's where it's just super convenient. You can hem your pants at your kitchen table, at your office, in the crib room, like whatever's easy.
So you've got a patent pending on this or you've got a patent?
Patent pending, yes.
Patent pending,
yeah.
Okay.
And we've registered it all across the world.
That's very interesting. All right. So could I just talk about that patent pending thing? So when you say you're registered all across the world, the process, you know, what you just went through then and however you describe it is what your patent attorney will lodge. How expensive is it to lodge something across the world?
Very the short answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I say all across the world, we've got it in the main hubs, right? We've got it in the US, we've got it in Europe, we've got it in New Zealand, South America, China. So we've got it, yeah, and not in every country, but a pretty good.
But how do you find someone who can do that shit? Like, I mean, like, is it your one dude here from Brisbane?
He's done it all. Yeah, they've got agents, right? It's just like we have business relationships with. Yeah. You know, different brands, and you help each other out, and it's the same in that profession.
So your the HEMS patent is registered in most of the relevant countries for yourself. I mean, does it take a long time? Like,
yeah, it took a few years.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever read a patent application. It's complex. So when the first draft came through, it took me about a month to read it, because I'd read the first page and I'm like, I don't understand what it's actually saying. It's a different – the way you write is different. It's more scientific. So it just took me a long time, and then I just kept reading it, and then it's become second nature sort of thing. But the process of getting it registered, I came close to giving it up. Like, giving up, it was too hard many, many times. Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm – strong at, you know, words and that sort of stuff. I am a creative. I see things in pictures, not so much in words. So it was definitely a struggle for me. But I think it's come back to, you know, you just don't give up. I am of the firm belief of you can't fail if you don't quit.
Yeah. So I presume your patent attorney had the first crack at the words. So
Definitely. He wrote it all. I showed him how it works, and they go and do their magic.
Yeah, they put in the science towards it, or the mathematics or the physics or whatever it is that they're applying to it, which is sort of what, you know, patents are about, is about protecting intellectual property around something that's been invented effectively, which is what you invented. You invented something, and it does take a long time. It is quite an expensive exercise, but what I like the sound of is that one individual your patent attorney in Brisbane can actually orchestrate the whole thing, so you're not trying to find patent attorneys all around the world. And in terms of the decision-making as to where you're going to register these patents, as you say, you can't patent every single country or every single region. It's just impossible.
No.
You're not going to do it in Russia, for example, or wherever. I mean, they don't really abide by the rules anyway. It doesn't matter what you register. And then you don't want to have an argument in some weird place either, because, you know, you're going to have to get lawyers to argue the case. But so do you feel relatively protected then in terms of what you've invented?
That's an interesting question. I feel confident in what we've been able to deliver. I think as soon as you become, I don't know, arrogant maybe is a word you could use.
I have a cocky.
In saying, yeah, that, you know, we've got this, we're safe forever. I don't have that mindset. Like, I think you've got to keep inventing, keep seeing how it can be improved. Yeah, I think that's like the growth mindset, really. And we're not going to, we just couldn't afford to register it in absolutely every country. But that's where you have to then associate a brand to it and build up the HEMS brand. So if you think of Lycra or Gore-Tex, like Lycra is in Nike products. And then once you put them together, it's a really strong, you know, they've got that brand around it where other brands want to work with them because it's a proven product.
Yeah. So therefore you registered the trademark, which is a different IP for HMZ, which is HEMS.
Yes.
So the two together sort of give you, relatively speaking, more protection as to what you're doing.
That was definitely the thought process and the strategy behind it.
Right. So just take me a little bit forward now. So, you know, you're off and running. You got your intellectual property registered. You solved a number of problems. You got your various SKUs for workwear for women. How's it looking now? You exporting to any other countries? Have you brought investors in? Have you just made a decision to sell? What are you doing?
Yeah, it's a very timely question, but the short answer is Kogia will be Australia market. When you start looking at hi-vis in different countries. They've got different standards. There's a few tweaks that need to be made. Whereas we've got a really strong presence here, and it's building momentum. Our products, I stand behind them. Like, now they are great. We had a shaky start, but now we are great. And it was all funded by me. So in the early days when things weren't really cash positive, I worked in the mining industry for the first 7 years. So that gave me the cash and the ability to not seek out other money, but also not have the stress of, if something didn't go well, that was on me. I didn't have to explain it to someone else and then front up and say, hey, now can I please have more money? So I took the responsibility of the failure, and now that it's going well with HEMS, it's a different ball game. So HEMS can, my bigger picture vision is we can change the face of fashion and the textile industry and change the way that we consume products. So it's on workwear. We license this functionality out to other brands. So in the future, you might see it on King G or something, because it reduces their SKUs as well. They hold men's pants in the length options that we discussed. So you could reduce that by 3. So your warehouse space can effectively get smaller. Your forecasting is better because you're just forecasting straight sizes, not lengths as well. So there's definitely ways you can optimize in inventory with HEMS. And then you're providing a wonderful service to the end users who no longer have to go and spend money to get their clothes altered. So we want to license it out to other brands. But in the space of changing how we can consume, if you think about a denim jacket, for instance, we, in some wardrobes, we have a denim jacket, we have a denim vest, and then you can have it cropped, and then you can have it long length. Imagine if that was in one product. Imagine if you just had one denim jacket that had the HEMS features on it, where in summer and you want it, I'll say it's spring, and you want a bit of warmth but you don't want the sleeves, you can just tear away the sleeves. And then you could go to, for instance, a HEMS bar, and then in winter you want the sleeves put on so we can sew them back on. So I think there's a way we can tackle the textile overconsumption habit that we're in and look at it a different way.
And you can also respond to fashion, because the fashion might demand a shorter length jacket in the case, for example, just giving another, then another period, so might demand a longer jacket or a sleeve jacket or sleeveless jacket, etc. And so you're basically maybe is also tackling the issue of wastage. So where you at? You're looking for investors or what?
For HEMS, definitely open for it.
Yeah. So are you doing rounds?
Mark, to be 100% honest, I have no clue how that works.
Yeah.
Any guidance you can offer would be appreciated.
Well, generally speaking, it's a bit like how you just went around door knocking to get your product sold in the first place, or bought and or demanded in the first place. I mean, it's really, knowing who to go to. And in the case of, who you went and saw, you knew who to go to because you're sort of in the mining industry. But the same as in the private equity investor industry, it's about knowing who to go to. There's a whole lot of typical ones, the ones that are well known, like Airtree Ventures, those sorts of entities here, Blackbird, et cetera, they're all in Sydney and Melbourne. You just got to go and talk to them and say, this is what I'm doing. Are you interested? And these things take a long time, an inordinate amount of time. At some stage you might, decide to not talk to them and get somebody to front for you, be your broker. That's an expensive exercise because, generally speaking, you've got to give away some of the money or equity. I would have thought right now, just talking to all the usual venture capitalists, because this is a venture at this stage, venture capitalists would be a good way to start this up. Two of which I just mentioned.
What about you, Mark? Would you
maybe? Normally I come in through them, though. That's the way people like me come in.
Yeah, right.
We come in through these organisations because, we like to see them anchor it. We get them to put the biggest investment in, and because I tell you why, high net wealths don't want to do the work. We don't have time. We don't have the time to do the due diligence on it. We don't have the time to manage. We don't have the time to be receiving reports, reading the reports. We either don't have the time or we don't want to allocate the time for whatever reason. So generally speaking, you rely on an anchor like a big venture capitalist who does all the legwork for you. They do all the heavy lifting. They talk to you. They put on a board member. You report to them. They report to us. And generally speaking, and what happens with these organizations is they do their rounds too. So you go to see them. They see this is something that's interesting. Then they go and talk to all their normal people that invest with them, co-invest. So at venture, a lot of people like to co-invest with a venture capitalist. And they're not, it sounds like a terrible word, venture capitalists, but they're just organizations who do this stuff all day long.
Yeah.
And they generally speaking try to get a board seat. They might, and they'll help you out too. So they give you a lot of input.
So I've heard you say on this show before that there's a partner called like a scale partner.
Yeah.
So how do you get smart money? So say I want you to be on the board because of your background in, you know, your financial side of things.
That's a separate conversation. So that if you're looking to bolster your board or your advisory board, let's call it, in order to raise money, for example, or in order to just feel comfortable, what you're going to do, you can see those individuals separately. But a lot of these venture capital organizations, by the way, have access to these sorts of people anyway. And then sometimes they'll even precondition it in order for them to invest. They want to see someone like this on the board. So they might say, look, you probably not strong in, I don't know, you probably are strong, but I'm just making this up. You're not strong in the financial management side of things. So we'd like you to see you put a CFO style person on your board. We have someone we want to suggest to you. And they might precondition it up, as make it a precondition of them actually giving you the money. They might say, "Oh, look, we'll give you money. Let's say you're trying to raise $1 million. We'll give you $200,000 now, and we'll give you $200,000 in 2 months' time, and like in milestone tranches. But in the third tranche, we want to make sure that at that stage you have a financial controller or someone on your board or your advisory board." Advisory boards are better, by the way, because a board of director position of the corporation has a whole lot of ASIC obligations attached to it.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't like to take on those roles because they're non-executive functions, but they carry personal liability. Mm. And you might say, well, I get D&O insurance because, you know, normally those directors would want some insurance, directors and officers insurance. But that's a very expensive exercise for you.
And it's just another expense.
And it's quite expensive too, especially with mines and stuff like that. I just don't know what the ramifications could be. But an advisory board's different. So that sits to the side of the board of directors and doesn't have ASIC regulatory sort of implications to it. Mm. But an advisory board can talk to you about whatever you want to talk to me, and you can talk to them whatever you want to talk to them about.
Yeah.
But a lot of the venture capitalists will put someone in or give you an idea who they want in there. Or if you want to do this before, in other words, bolster your ability, if you think you need to bolster your suite of advice in order to attract investment, if you think that's the way you want to go, then generally speaking, people like you would go out and see these individuals yourself. You know, you might, if it's finance, you might come and see someone like me. You might say, well, I'll go and talk to Mark and see if he's if I'm interested, for example, or available for that matter. But I think all the VCs, they can do it. All this work can get done for you by them.
Right.
I don't think they would begrudge you if you didn't have an advisory board, but you would like to have an advisory board.
Yeah,
they would probably help you get one.
Yeah, right.
Because that's
and
good
do
for them.
You pay them or do
you,
they?
No,
get
no, they, you would pay the individual. Okay. You would pay the individual. You don't pay the VC for doing it.
Oh, right.
They invest in you. Part of the money that you're raising, you would say, will go to pay the advisory board. Let's say you have two people on there, for example. You know, and let's say it's, I don't know, whatever, you're going to pay them $50,000 a year, whatever the case may be. You would say, on my advisory board, I feel as these are two areas I could improve on or do much better on in terms of what I want to export and design, et cetera. I need maybe a creative and I need a finance person. I'm going to pay them $50,000 a year. That's $100,000 each. That's $100,000 a year. You would say to the VC, I'm trying to raise $5 million. And for the next 3 years, $300,000 of that will be spent on this particular individuals, these types of individuals. Could you advise? Do you have any? Sometimes good to say to them. Do you VC have any preferences as to who you would like to have on there? Because they like to have their own people.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, because they're people they know,
proven track records, and
just people they know who they like to work with. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that have proven track records, but you know, VCs know who they like to work with. You know, they've had good relationships. It's about relationships. They've got good relationships, and they know what they're going to get. And the VCs will, if they, generally speaking, if you've got a VC who anchors the capital raise, like, you know, let's say you're raising $1 million and they say, we'll put in $500,000. A lot of times they won't put in less than $500,000. Mm-hmm. Then if you see, it's easier then to get high net wealths once they know that there's a VC in there. The last thing a high net wealth wants to do is have to go and say, oh, I could sit at a management meeting, you know, read management accounts every month or whatever the case may be, or start asking you, oh, here's a shareholders agreement. You go to a VC, they'll give you a shareholders agreement. Yeah. They'll say, this is our shareholders agreement. This is one we want to do.
Yeah.
And then most of the high net wealths go, we know that one, so yeah, we'll invest alongside them.
Right, okay.
Because they're doing the work.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
There are people who would give advice on these things, but if I was you, I mean, I think your stuff is advanced enough and already proven that, you know, you could probably go and just see the top, just Google like you did with everything else. Who are the top three, you know, or the top five venture capitalists in Sydney?
Yeah, right.
Well, Kim O'Leary, thanks very much. This was fascinating. I really enjoyed it a lot and well done. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And yeah, thanks for taking the time to explain the investment side of things to me.
You're most welcome.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.